This is an interesting topic that I brought up a few times today. So when I hear things like this, I think, you know what? It's time for me to address it. I've done videos on this in the past. This is one of the biggest misconceptions for law enforcement officers. And often we learn these bad practices through a lack of understanding or knowledge. And that's okay. That's what we're here for. And I just want to continue to encourage everybody. Like, we have products that are available for free, namely a U.S. Supreme Court case law webinar that I did during the COVID pandemic. Obviously, we're still with it, but now we're actually in the field training in some places. It's a 4.5-hour webinar that I did, streetcop.com. Check it out. Watch it. It really gives you a basis to understand maybe the 30 most important U.S. Supreme Court cases that came out. That's the first 30 for police officers. And the thing we're going to talk about today, which is a big misconception, is the pat frisk for weapons. This is actually how we opened the two-day program. If you ever attended it or you plan on attending it, you're going to hear this again. And I'm going to try to cover it in great detail and talk about it. There's a big misconception, and it's often taught in police academies, field training, or it's the way things have been done at police departments through the course of history. And that is, when somebody comes out of a car in a traffic stop, which we know in Pennsylvania versus Mims or Maryland v. Wilson, that pertains to both the driver and the passengers in a car, and not needing a reasonable suspicion, depending on what state you're in, for your ability to remove somebody from a vehicle off to the side of the road. And the reason you're allowed to do that is for safety purposes. So you don't need reasonable suspicion in most states to ask the passenger, the driver or passengers out of the car. Now, once they come out of the car, a lot of people are under this misconception that they can automatically pat frisk people for weapons. So let's start going into the idea of this. We had a case come out in, I want to say 1967, it was called Terry v. Ohio. And I'll put it in the accompanying notes here. But you should be familiar with Terry v. Ohio. I'm not trying to pick on you. I'm just trying to give you advice that if I was a newer guy or somebody who's been around for a while or a supervisor, spend time and read at least Terry v. Ohio and the principles. Terry v. Ohio is probably one of those top three landmark cases for us. Maybe even number one, to be honest with you. Because when you run Terry v. Ohio in a search, against your state in Google Scholar or Case Text, you're going to see that they're going to have the most issues relating to police officers and the application of Terry v. Ohio, because it has to do with investigative detentions, when you can compel identification, and when you can Terry frisk somebody for weapons. So that's what they call it, a Terry frisk. It's a pat frisk for weapons. The first thing I want to discuss is when you write in your report that I arrested him or placed him or her under arrest and then pat frisk them for safety, that language would reveal to a defense attorney that you probably don't know what you're talking about. I'm not picking on you. I'm here to help you. I'm on your side, right? You see the flag behind me and this other thing over here? That's the blue line. See this thing on my chest? I've decided to go this route and to help the people that needed to be helped, not the defense, not the people who are the accused. So when you're using language like, I then place Jones under arrest, the language you want to use is then I search Jones incident to arrest. A search and a Terry frisk for weapon are two different things. With a search, you're allowed to be a little more intrusive than a Terry frisk for weapons. You're allowed to check pockets and you can look for contraband. The idea is it's incident to arrest to prevent a police officer from being attacked with a weapon or contraband being hidden or destroyed, destruction of evidence. So that's what gives us the ability to search somebody incident to arrest. On a quick side note, don't forget there is no search incident to citation. Just because you could have arrested somebody and you opted to issue them a citation doesn't mean you get to search them because you could have arrested them. See Knowles v. Iowa, U.S. Supreme Court case. A lot of people get confused on that one too since we're on the topic. But in order to Terry frisk somebody, a lot of people are under the impression that merely because somebody comes out of the car, it now raises their safety concern, which I guess in hindsight really does raise a safety concern. It actually lowers safety concerns because you're removing them from the vehicle where it's the most dangerous place to leave somebody on a traffic stop, especially when you have reasonable suspicion, right? Or you're pretexting vehicles and stopping them for said purpose. So when they come out of a car, there is no automatic rule that you get to Terry frisk somebody for weapons. The government has levels of protection, and the body itself is the most protected under the Fourth Amendment. Second is the house, and third is the vehicle, right? So there's different levels of protection the Fourth Amendment affords, and we all have to follow the U.S. Supreme Court. There's nothing in your state that says anything differently. When I travel around this country, I read case law. Obviously, I research about 6 to 8 hours of case law per state. Regarding the 25 to 30 cases that we'll cover, just to get people straightened out and on the up and up and know how to use the techniques that we employ and why they're legal and why you can do it, and this is what your state says. So if there's anybody who disagrees with any of the advice we're given, it's not us you're disagreeing with. It's the facts. And the facts you can't win against because it's the truth, and the truth is undefeated. So there is a common misconception that merely because somebody steps out of a car that they can be Terry Frisk. Now, what I want to tell you is I do think it's a good idea to pat frisk somebody when they come out of a car. However, you just don't get that automatically as a protocol because that's the way it's been done here. Terry v. Ohio is constantly regarded for this. There are many cases in many states that I see cops doing this. Then they find something, maybe a gun, and they are failing to articulate how they believe the person that they were dealing with was armed and dangerous. You need to be able to satisfy that prong, that proxy, that the person is, in fact, that you have reason to believe through fair and objective factors that the person that you're dealing with, that you intruded upon the sanctity of their body, the most protected Fourth Amendment portion of living in the United States, how you believed or are going to articulate that they were in fact armed and dangerous. Now, some states say armed is dangerous. So like, let's say you're driving in a state where the person has a carry permit. As long as you've achieved the investigative detention, whether it's a motor vehicle violation or some kind of stop for an investigation, that they will then allow you to Terry frisk somebody based on the fact that they are armed with a weapon, even though legally, and some states say no. Some states say, I think we were just in, and I don't want to misquote this, I think in Alabama they said no. But don't take that. I'm just off the top of my head. I know I read one recently, and I was just in Alabama. I remember talking about that when I was there regarding their state says no, and other states say yes. Other states say yes, armed is dangerous. I thought somewhere this year where it said armed is dangerous. I just forget where. But each state is different. And if you ask Zach Miller, and we've talked about this, it's split right down the middle. So you must be able to convey or articulate in your report why you took an intrusion upon the sanctity of somebody's body in order to commit a or perform a Terry frisk for weapons. Don't forget, a Terry frisk is about a 3 second, 3 to 5 second hand over the outer portions of the clothing, right? Doesn't go. You can't go into pockets. You can't go into shoes looking for bumps or bulges or places where somebody would conceal or harbor a weapon. This is not a contraband search. It's a weapon search strictly. So you have to understand that. When you get on the stand and you perform one of these searches incorrectly and you start saying things, well, I was looking for contraband. No, it's how we usually do things here. You are setting yourself up for a suppression. So what happens is these guys and girls throughout the country think it's automatic because nobody's ever told them differently. They'll do the Terry frisk. They'll find something and fail to articulate why. Now, as I said to you earlier, I think it's a really good idea that you do Terry frisk people. And in most states, there is an accepted practice to the warrant requirement, right? There's an accepted exception to the written warrant requirement, and that is consent to search. Now, you got to know what consent says in each of your states, because it does vary from state to state. Not everybody follows the U.S. Constitution, namely New Jersey. New Jersey makes it much more difficult in the state of New Jersey to request consent to search in the motor vehicle setting only, not in a Terry-style situation where you're showing up just in motor vehicle stops. New Jersey has, in our State versus Cardi court case in 2002, they have required police officers in the state of New Jersey a requisite to have reasonable suspicion of criminal activity before a consent procedure can be performed. And then we also have to advise people here in this state, and we're not following Schlenkloth versus Bustamante, which is a U.S. Supreme Court decision. We actually have to advise people of the right to refuse. Most states don't require that, right? Some states require much more. So you got to know what your state says regarding the consent procedures. What we're trying to tell you to do is do things legally. And if you want to frisk people because you think it's safe, great. I implore you to go ahead and do that. But make sure you're doing it in a legal function. And consent to search will be the exception to the written warrant requirement. There is no such thing as an automatic pat frisk. Now, people say, well, what if you think they have drugs on them? Well, if they have drugs on them and you believe that, well, that fixes things for New Jersey. But let's go to other states as well. Again, you must check your states and be state specific. If you're going to request consent, don't forget it has to be knowing, intelligent, and usually voluntary, right? Some states require the first two, but New Jersey also requires the voluntary consent procedure. But they're all going to be the same. These are three good prongs you want to visit. So let's go back into that a little bit. If you're looking to search somebody for contraband, well, then you can ask for such, right? You can ask somebody to search them for contraband. Do you have drugs and contraband or anything illegal on your person? And then request consent to search. Following the principles of Florida v. Jiminel, be specific on where you want to search, because you know what? You're better off getting denied out there than find yourself in a suppression hearing and setting yourself up for a civil litigation issue. You don't want that. So you want to make sure you're doing consent voluntarily, knowingly, and intelligently. So things to know, my case law, research is ultimately important. And you know what, honestly, we get that 99% of people are not going to read case law. And that's why we have classes that discuss these things. So we're trying to get everybody in line with performing legally. We know that it wasn't intentional that you did these things. We know that you learned it from the guy or to the left or the girl to your right or your FTO or your academy that's been outdated and has been updated in 28 years. You know, like, and even then, the program is defunct. We understand that, right? So we're just trying to get everybody to understand, you know, why you need to meet certain criteria to perform the actions that you do. And then when you do these things, you have legal documentation explaining exactly why you did it, where you did it. Yeah, I always find it interesting that, you know, we offer these programs to help you. And some people, you know, will be in your area and you'll negate the attendance. And it's just valuable. I mean, the trade-off for our programs is tremendous. I mean, the leverage is on the consumer side more than the corporation side, for sure. And, you know, you see it in results that the people talk about in class. So if you're having difficulties understanding this, or you thought otherwise, it's important that you do the research. It doesn't even have to be with us. Just make sure that the source of information you're getting from is citing legal jargon and case law. Today has been one of those interesting days where I have dealt with a lot of mud being slung my way. And it's so comical that other organizations spend time in their courses trying to, you know, who knows, slander the kind of work that we're doing. But the reality is we're literally explaining to everybody how to do things legally. But unfortunately, when people get exposed for not knowing what those legal procedures are, they get very upset, like trap rats, you know what I mean? Like start getting like lashing out. So with any kind of attention, when we do good work, there's always gonna be negative tension thrown our way. So if you ever hear anything like that, but what I wanna implore you to do is we don't spend time talking badly about other organizations. What we wanna tell you is just make sure you're fact-checking who you are getting your information from and reading the case law, citing that. I would even hold it up against casetext.com to see if they've been overruled or negatively treated upon review, anything like that. The things that we're talking about here, you're going to find that are 100% reliable. We are not in the business of reciting information or recycling information that's incorrect or invalid. We can prove everything we say. And by the way, there's also a case that I think you should read called Minnesota v. Dickerson. Now, Minnesota v. Dickerson said this, since we're on this topic. Minnesota v. Dickerson said, well, during a Terry frisk for weapons, if a police officer discovers or touches an object and immediately recognizes it as contraband, some kind of illegal contraband, right? If the officer, at the very second that police officer's fingertips touch that item, he or she recognizes it as contraband, an illegal item, and has probable cause to believe that it is illegal contraband, they can seize that item under the plain view doctrine. Why? Because you're already authorized in that particular area to check for something. So what does that mean? If you've got consent to do a Terry frisk or you have the requisite of armed and dangerous to do a Terry frisk, if you touch an item and you, like, let's pretend this is my front pocket or maybe it's my shirt pocket, and you stop and go, ha, I know that to be a crack pipe. Ah, I know that to be crack cocaine. I know what that feels like. That's a bundle of heroin, a brick of heroin. And we say brick in New Jersey, it's a different meaning versus the kilos throughout the country, different vernacular and terms for different parts of the country, right? So you can then place the person under arrest and retrieve those items or retrieve the item, then place the person under arrest. Don't forget, Rawlings v. Kentucky said handcuffs aren't the thing that connect or make an arrest legitimate. We don't find that the U.S. Supreme Court and every state in the country has agreed that as long as the connection is not remote in time or place, the search can precede the arrest and vice versa. So however you want to do it. So the problem is this. If you begin to manipulate, if you're doing a Terry frisk and you stop and go, hey, and you start rubbing this and document or body-worn cameras that you're rubbing it, trying to figure out what it is, you have now violated the Fourth Amendment because that did not permit you to stop and start to feel it. You can go for consent even further, but you're not allowed to manipulate with your fingers. Just like an exploratory search in a bag. You just can't pick up somebody's bag and start feeling it to try to guess what's inside. It doesn't work that way. So when you know what the law says, you can behave in accordance with it and rest assured when you show up to court or if somebody's criticizing the type of work that you do, you have legal documentation supporting it. What I say to everybody is this. If somebody does not agree with this video or the legal factual data that we have rehearsed, we have a team of legal people here, right? And that's including myself. Please show us supporting evidence where it says otherwise. Until then, we have nothing to discuss. If you have something that says otherwise, we'd love to hear it. Now, just so you know, Some states are very giving with what they consider to be armed and dangerous enough for a Terry frisk. Rhode Island, off the top of my head, has some great case law for their police officers. And when they felt somebody was armed and dangerous and authorized a Terry frisk. We were just in Indiana. Okay, sorry. Brain fart. Just in LaPorte, Indiana. Indiana's got good case law on what they consider to be armed and dangerous. They have good case law overall. I mean, they're a state that has the odor of marijuana, probable cause to arrest. I was actually on the phone with one of their prosecutors today who's now in AUSA. She's really cool. Excited for her to be interested in joining our team. Really seems to know her stuff, so excited for that. But outside of that, I'm going to just comment back to a few people, and then we're going to call it a day because it's 6:45 Eastern Standard Time. And I have still more work to do before I get to go home to my family. I've been here since 9 o'clock and just part of the gig of being the guy. All right, Tommy Rizzo. Hey, Tom. We'll see you guys Saturday, hopefully. Rizzo's and Beninos, very tight-knit group. No nepotism in the company. That's for sure. It doesn't exist here because I hated it. Politics, nepotism. But a lot of love for the Rizzos. Mike Brazil gets one of the most common misconceptions. Mike Brazil is a Indiana attorney, street cop instructor. He is saying that. Thanks for having these live videos. Yeah, Ryan Schleo, my pleasure, man. The world was speaking to me. I know this is one that is commonly misconceived. And I did a video a while back, the first time I was in the Gulf Coast in Mississippi. And I haven't done one since. So just some more clarification. We have a lot of new members, 67,000 members in this group now, all police officers. And I'm thankful that all you were there. If there's anything I can do for you, our staff can do for you here, that's what we're here for, right? When you look that good, does Terry, Ohio, even the Ohio, even apply to you? It actually doesn't. So thanks for pointing that out, Johnny Rich. Kyle Smith, what is the case law about search incident to arrest, not applying to citations arrest? That's California. So you're going to search Knowles v. Iowa. It's K-N-O-W-L-E-S v. Iowa. Now, when you read it, it's going to have to do with the Belt and Bright Line rule and search incident to arrest of a vehicle, but the principles are the same. The principle was you cannot search vehicles or search incident to arrest, incident to citation. Let me back that up. You cannot search incident to citation. And when you read that case, again, I'm going off the top of my head, they talk about there's a reason why you're allowed to search incident to arrest. And it was for those foregoing reasons I said before, to prevent a police officer from being injured, the suspect injuring themselves, or destruction of evidence. So with preservation of evidence, you don't get that if you're releasing somebody from the scene. Knowles v. Iowa applies in every, it's a U.S. Supreme Court decision. People are confused in that one, but I want everybody performing correctly. Knowles v. Iowa. There you go. Mike Brazil jumping in. Uncle Den, is there a limit as to how long an armed and dangerous bolo is valid for? And case law behind that answer? For example, an individual on a bolo is pushed out to the department. On the bolo states the person should be considered armed and dangerous. Come in contact with the person having RS of a crime being committed. Okay, we've got a lot going on here. So you have RS of a crime being committed. Valid Terry frisk based off the bolo. Or would you need RS that they are armed and dangerous at that moment? I'm leaning towards you'll need it at that moment. Just curious of your thoughts. I'm going to agree with you. Certainly having, first off, here's the issue. It depends what your state says. There are going to be states that agree that, yes, the bolo of this on the previous thing, but there's no question about it. Having being armed with that bolo is going to be a major factor in whether or not the Terry frisk was authorized. You know, I certainly wouldn't, if you were in that situation, asking for consent to Terry frisk would solve this issue. You'd have to worry about, did I have enough reasonable suspicion? Don't forget for the New Jersey guys and girls, the only time you need reasonable suspicion of criminal activity or is in a motor vehicle setting to ask for consent. Outside of the motor vehicle setting for New Jersey guys and girls, we don't need that. You can just perform normally. You can ask consent normally. It's only in that. If you read State versus Domicz, D-O-M-I-C-Z, that's where the court said, no, we're only limiting that to the motor vehicle. So I think Domicz was out of, I can't think of the year, 2005, late 90s. I think it's in the 2000s. Maybe 2012. I haven't read it in a while, but I can. So that's my answer to that. When in doubt, ask for consent. You're obviously not going to go with a search warrant in these situations because it's inherently dangerous. And you don't have time. So you'll have exigent circumstances if you believe you're armed and dangerous. But it will at least at a very minimum be a factor. And to be quite honest with you, just because I haven't read something on a bolo at the U.S. Supreme Court level doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So it may. And that's my answer for now without further research into it. If Mike Brazil knows anything else or Zach Miller's watching this, please comment if I'm missing something on this. But I do think it's going to come down to the state-by-state thing. And by the way, I think the there when you asked about the timeliness of the BOLO being put out, did that matter? Well, yeah, that's going to be another factor that takes that comes into account. Are you going to be able to do a Terry Frisk on a BOLO that you saw from 9 months ago, right? Especially the guy, you know, so all these factors, I try to get the best questions that apply broadly where you can use them and are going to have the best legal results. So hopefully that answers your question, Sam. Thanks for asking. Adam Jack, Pat Frisk at MA slowly being non-existent. I think Massachusetts is literally going to just secede from the rest of the country and be a safe haven for all criminals. And then Connecticut is going to be another good one. It looks like Virginia's up for another safe haven for criminals. It looks like they're really trying to harbor and protect their criminals in their states. So congratulations to all those states. And the Democratic litigation, which was a knee-jerk reaction to a problem that didn't exist. Congratulations, everybody. Your elected officials are putting people in more public danger and making police officers, quote-unquote, technically, have to go further and further. And essentially, it becomes a violation in a worse manner than the already set precedent. So congratulations to all those states. Okay, Mike Brazil said there. Cool stuff. Let's see. Okay, we got something up here. Let's just see who wrote to me. I have some questions on Instagram. Can you elaborate on Terry Frisk on MVStop? How to articulate in a report? That is from Justin on Instagram. The elaboration of it. Look, so go into Case Text or Google Scholar. I've done videos of it. If you guys in Instagram aren't in the group on Facebook, we've done 4 years of content in the group on Facebook. Just about. I think this January will be 4 years of the group being open. There's a lot of research you can do. You can use the search function and look into this. But essentially, what I want you to do is look into how to use casetext.com. It's a 14-day free trial. I don't work for them. It's just an easy product to use. Google Scholar. Search Terry v. Ohio and select your state and read the cases regarding Terry v. Ohio. They'll tell you which ones were good and which ones are bad. You'll go through, I mean, there'll be plenty of cases, and they'll tell you this was enough for it. This was not enough for it. So when you read that, you know how to behave in the field. Okay, if they said I needed five things for this to be good, do I have those five things or am I falling short with just two? I'm going to have to make it, I'm going to have to elaborate why I found these other five things. So that's my best answer. What is that case law about requiring it's only a voluntary basis? What was the case law about requiring? So there's many cases at the U.S. Supreme Court level regarding voluntary consent. Off the top of my head, Schlenkloth v. Bustamante, and that's spelled S-C-H-L-E-N-C-L-O-T-H. There's a K in there somewhere, too. Schlenkloth. It's not the C, it's the K. Versus Bustamante, B-U-S-T-A-M-O-N-T-E. That's U.S. Supreme Court. We have United States v. Mendenhall, which are Mendenhall factors, which is commonly referred to in a lot of case law reciting. We have Ohio v. Robinette. We have United States v. Watson. Those are four off the top of my head, are good places to start. So Robinette is Ohio v. Robinette, R-O-B-I-N-E-T-T-E. If you start typing into Google, they'll come up. You'll find them. And those are the cases that you can start with. If you're in a state and I have case law written for you, you can email me, dennis@streetcoptraining.com. Guys, I know some people are waiting for me to get back to their emails, but I will eventually get back to them. I'm extremely busy. I'd have to prioritize what I do in my days. I have a lot more going on in my personal life, too, as well. All good things, but I have people that I take care of. And I don't, care to share that here in the group. But I, at times I'm overwhelmed. That's why I'm hiring a personal assistant. So send me that. If I have the case law version for you, and it's not found in the file section on the Facebook group, I will certainly email it to you. I don't hide things from people. We are not in the game of, oh, you didn't pay. That means you can't have. No, we're in the game of, look, you want to come to class and have a great experience? Awesome. If you don't, but you want the material, it doesn't mean you don't get to come and get the information to keep you alive or perform legally correct. So you can email there. And a means of escape. Okay, Lamar Moore, Springfield. You helped me with a shit ton, bro. Thanks, Lamar Moore. Appreciate it. Springfield, Illinois. Man, I had crazy thing about Springfield, Illinois when I was there. Strange town. But I had delicious Italian food there. I would never in a fucking million years think I would have great Italian food in Springfield, Illinois. Here's another crazy one. Little Rock, Arkansas, the best mozzarella sticks of my life. Is that possible? Some of my Italian friends from New Jersey say, you go say mozzarella? You didn't say mozzarella? I don't know. Sorry. My grandmother's probably turned over in her grave. Cool. Mike said it'll help out. Guys, I think this is the end of the program. Streetcop.com for today's live video. If you need anything from me, feel free to reach out. We are here to help you, and we appreciate everybody's continued participation in this group. If you have something that you don't agree with, love to hear from you. Bye.